Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is out of prison. For the first time in 13 years, Illinois doesn't have a governor behind bars. And the transition from childhood to early adulthood can be bumpy for any family, but especially for young people with autism. We'll hear about a program that aims to help. For 37 years, the Insect Fear Film Festival in Urbana has featured different kinds of insects and related critters. For this year's event, crustaceans will be front and center.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Julian Haida. Earlier this week, former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was released from prison after President Trump commuted his 14-year sentence in federal prison. Blagojevich was convicted in 2011 of crimes that included seeking to sell an appointment to Barack Obama's old Senate seat and trying to shake down a children's hospital. In a few minutes, Mark Maurer from the Sentencing Project will join us for some more context about the commutation and Blagojevich's original sentence. But first, earlier this morning, we had a chance to check in with WBEZ's state politics reporter, Dave McKinney. Dave is also the host of the Public Official A podcast, which tackles the rise and fall of Blagojevich. Dave McKinney, welcome back to the 21st. We really appreciate your time, given how busy your morning's been.
Yes, how are you this morning?
Good, thank you. So before there was talk about a possible commutation, before President Trump was president, the two men, Blagojevich and President Trump, knew each other in a different capacity. Back in 2010, Blagojevich went on a media blitz. It included a stop on the president's show, The Celebrity Apprentice. You actually played a clip from that, from an episode on Public Official A. Let's have a listen to that.
So, Governor, you have a hell of a lot of guts, I have to tell you that. I have friends where things have happened to them. They crawl into a corner, they die. You're out there punching, so I respect that.
Well, I appreciate that.
So, unfortunately for Blagojevich, just a few episodes in, he was the recipient of the famous Trump, you are fired, quote. Dave, what's the relationship between Trump and Blago like all those years ago? And do you think that that played at all into the commutation?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly they had this relationship where, you know, don't forget, you put it in the proper context there, where Rod was facing enormous legal problems because of, you know, the feds had basically built their case against him at that point, but he was still facing, you know, working his way through the trials. But, you know, they established this rapport there. I don't know that they were particularly close in the aftermath of that, but what we did see, or what you do see, is this kind of trail of interviews after that and tweets where Trump, before becoming president, expresses sympathy, empathy for what Blagojevich has gone through. And so you could see that kind of early seed planted in Trump's head that he thought that Blagojevich was being screwed by the system. And so I think what, you know, it's not terribly surprising that these, you know, that we would be at the point we are now where Blagojevich is now a free man because of Donald Trump. But, you know, it's a strange relationship. I don't think that they are close personal friends, but they also have this series of common threads where, you know, they have, you know, some people will say that they both have kind of a narcissistic component to their personalities where they like being in the middle of things and out front. Of course, both of them have been impeached. You know, so you've got this kind of, well, I could throw one other thing out there. Both had kind of fixations with their hair, you know, I mean, Blagojevich more so than other, than Trump, I mean. So, you know, it's just it's such a strange confluence of events here. But you know, as I'm sure we're going to be working into. I mean, yesterday, outside of Blagojevich's home, I mean, it was just an absolute three-ring circus.
Yeah, there are people leaving teddy bears and signs and things that said, "Thank you, Mr. President. I heard, make Illinois great again." I mean, it's an oddly kind of bipartisan kind of combination of things. I mean, I read that Jared Kushner, for example, was suggesting this to the president as a way of ingratiating President Trump among Democrats. Is that a kind of calculus that you think is realistic?
Well, I mean, Blagojevich hasn't really shown his hand, nor has the president, about what the plans are, if there are any plans. I mean, it's impossible to forget the fact we are in an election year, and Trump, sort of like Blagojevich. I mean, he has this thing, and it's bleeping golden, I guess you could say. I mean, the pardon, the commutation, rather. Again, this is not a pardon. This is a commutation. I think that there is a possibility that Blagojevich could be an effective campaign surrogate for President Trump. I mean, especially if he were to go outside of places where he was well known. I mean, Blagojevich, certainly many people in Illinois will remember him and the dysfunction of his governorship. But if you are, say, if you're sitting in a church service on a Sunday morning and he comes to speak to your group there, he is compelling. He's a great public speaker. We saw some of that on display yesterday. And it's a thing where, there was a point in time when Rod Blagojevich was really popular with African-American voters. And I bring up that church idea because, he used to be really effective at working the black churches in Chicago, during his campaigns for governor.
He thanked the Reverend Jesse Jackson during his talk yesterday.
Absolutely. And if you look at the series of people that the White House cited as being as advocating in some way, shape or form for his early release, Jackson, Congressman Danny Davis, Congressman Bobby Rush. I mean, these guys are pillars in the black community in Chicago. So it would not be a strange thing. I mean, you could also see a scenario perhaps where since Patty, the First Lady, former First Lady, was so effective in getting herself on Fox News to try to plead to the president, you could easily envision a scenario where Fox News would, might decide to tap into the political knowledge base that Rod Blagojevich has, and could he be a token Democrat on Fox News, for example? I mean, any number of possibilities await. But I do think that, first and foremost for him, besides getting reacclimated to life outside of prison, is what is he going to do to make money? I mean, that's the reality here. He has no government pension, no source of income at the moment. He still has time, I would think time before he's ready to retire. He's got one daughter who's going to be heading into college. So big open question about what the future holds for Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a little bit earlier that Rod Blagojevich received a commutation, not necessarily a pardon. That means that he's still a convicted criminal. He'll deny it. How does he carry that forward?
There were a lot of political forces lined up against President Trump offering any kind of clemency to Rod Blagojevich. First and foremost, the Republican congressional delegation all were staunchly opposed to letting Rod Blagojevich out early. The House Republican leader, Jim Durkin, yesterday criticized the president and called Blagojevich the face of public corruption in Illinois. And Republicans, their fortunes have not been good in Illinois for, really the last decade since Blagojevich left and certainly since Quinn was defeated. But they're hoping to make inroads against the Democrats in Springfield. And to do that, they were hoping to use kind of this anti-corruption message because the Democrats, we've seen a couple of legislators targeted in criminal investigations. And there are a number of investigations that remain active and in which the Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, there have been questions raised about him. So Republicans want this corruption issue. And how is it that they're able to go after that when the president of their party, the president who belongs to their party is really, as Durkin said, giving a pass to the face of public corruption in Illinois.
Mm. Now, Dave, just in a word, you were there when a lot of this unfolded a decade ago. How does it feel? You're on the other side of this. What do you what's going through your head?
Well, when my colleague Colin McNulty and I spent time developing this podcast, Public Official A, that kind of showed the rise and the fall of Rod Blagojevich. I mean, we spent a lot of time with Patty Blagojevich, and you know, probably 5 or 6 hours over multiple sessions at their house, which was the backdrop to yesterday's big event. And you know, it's sort of hard to I think ultimately you spend time with these people, and you know, they've got little kid, or they had little kids. One is out of college now. One's still in high school, and it's like these young girls. I'm a parent, and I've always had empathy for these daughters, because, like, you know, they never signed up for this, and you know, they're the ones who spent a great deal of their childhood without a father, and so you are left with that. And you know, so I mean, I don't wish ill will on these people at all. I mean, you know, they're entitled to live their lives. But I do think the you know, there are serious questions about what the effect of an action like this is, especially in a state like Illinois, where corruption has just been so it's just now part of our character. You know, when we have this lineup of governors that dates back to the, you know, the 70s, the late 60s. I mean, you got governors that are constantly, you know, making a path to federal prison. And members of the city council in Chicago, members of the legislature. It's like every time somebody gets caught doing something and goes to prison, it seems like there's somebody else in line waiting after them and seemingly thinking they're smarter than the previous person. You know, that to me is the issue at hand here, where, yes, you feel sympathy for somebody who is spending a great deal of their life in prison and the people left behind. But I guarantee you, Rod Blagojevich and the Blagojevich family are not the only people facing this kind of hardship. There are lots of other people who don't have that tie to the president that Blagojevich did, or that these other people who were released from prison early or who got pardons did. You know, those people are still living this on a daily basis. So,
well, we're going to talk a little bit about that next. That was WBEZ state politics reporter Dave McKinney. You heard him mention the Public Official A podcast. You can download that wherever you get your podcasts. They actually just put out a new episode this week about Rod Blagojevich's commutation. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. As we've been hearing on Tuesday, President Donald Trump commuted former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's 14-year sentence in federal prison, along with 10 other white-collar criminals. At a press conference yesterday, here's how Blagojevich described his time behind bars.
The buildings behind that fence where the inmates live and sleep are squalid places. They're cold and dark like tombs. There were about 900 inmates there. Drug dealers, cartel members, gangbangers, bank robbers. There were men there who committed murder, con artists, a lot of sex offenders. About 2% of the population were in the so-called white-collar category.
Like I said, Blagojevich was among that white-collar category, among those white-collar criminals, though he chalks up his time in prison to being unfairly treated. Blagojevich cited the fact that the U.S. imprisons more people than Russia and China. Some, like Senator Dick Durbin, have argued in the past that Blagojevich's sentence was indeed too long, 14 years. But if yesterday's press conference was any indication, Governor Blagojevich thinks he's in the same boat as 2 million other incarcerated Americans. Except they didn't have the good fortune of being commuted by the president. For some perspective, I'm joined now by Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, which advocates for more moderate criminal sentencing laws here in America. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. So I feel like we've been thrust into this big conversation in recent days about prison sentences, given these high-profile cases. I mean, even today, Roger Stone is being sentenced. Why does the way we sentence criminals matter?
Well, it matters in terms of our public safety strategy. You know, prison incarceration is one element of public safety, but we have a variety of other ways we can invest in public safety. So we want to have a healthy economy, give people economic opportunity and the like. What's happened over the past four decades in the United States is that we've had an explosion in the prison population, far out of line with any changes in crime rates, essentially the end result of what's been called get tough policies, meaning sending more people to prison, keeping them for longer periods of time. And we know that in many, many cases, we're keeping people in prison far past the point at which they present any risk to public safety. So this is then costing enormous tax dollars to keep them there with diminishing returns for public safety. And also, as we've heard, it affects their families, their communities, their prospects of making it when they get out. So we do want to have a conversation about what is the appropriate use of incarceration and how could we get to a more rational level of sentencing policy.
Sure. Now, you mentioned threats to public safety, violent versus nonviolent, white-collar crimes, the kind that we're talking about here with Governor Blagojevich are at issue. I mean, I read a thing in the Washington Post that said Blagojevich was notorious for not commuting a lot of sentences, and he was, you know, the recipient of this kind of privilege. So how does that play into, as our previous guest mentioned, the overwhelming majority of inmates who really depend on things like commutations and pardons and things like that as almost built into the system?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, former Governor Blagojevich, like many other former state and local executives who've gone to prison, they discover the problems of incarceration only when they get to prison. And here they've been in charge of the prison system and the clemency process, and it just shows why we need to get them to focus more on it, and it shouldn't require incarceration. The challenge here, I think, is that, yes, sentences are generally far too long in the United States, but the clemency issue is a remedy, but the way it's done needs to be done fairly and justly. And clearly what's happening in this case, regardless of what one thinks about the justice of the commutation for Blagojevich, is that people in high places, people with access to the White House, get their cases for clemency heard. The tens of thousands of other people, many of whom are serving overly long sentences, their applications are sitting on a desk somewhere in the Justice Department and will never reach the
White House. It takes a lot of money and a lot of privilege to get to the top of that list. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. It advocates for more moderate criminal sentencing laws here in America. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, too. Yep.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Julian Haida. Early adulthood can be a huge transition for anyone, and for people with autism, this stage of life comes with its own unique challenges. Whether it's navigating complicated systems for support or finding resources outside of the school system, or planning for the long term, there's a lot to navigate. A program funded by the National Institute of Mental Health aims to help. WILL and Side Effects Health reporter Christine Herman recently spoke with two people involved in the research. Megan Burke is a professor of special education at the U of I, and Linda Tortorelli is the coordinator for the autism program at the University of Illinois. They spoke with Christine yesterday.
So, Linda, I wonder if we can just kind of dive right in here. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that families face when you have a child with autism, and in particular during this transition age in the late teens into the early 20s?
There are many challenges that face the individuals with autism and their families. Knowing what they would like to do, or what they might be capable of doing after they graduate high school can be challenging under the best circumstances. Having a person with autism that might not fully understand the expectation of their desires and their requirements can be difficult for families to try and figure out how to set those expectations within reason. Then the systems that need to be navigated, how to get special supports. If the individual is looking at post-secondary education, how do you access disability supports at colleges? And if your individual is not going to be going on to college and needs supports that agencies might be providing or community supports, all of those are really siloed. They're not coordinated at all. So how to navigate each one of them takes time to research and build expertise in access and then ongoing. Just because you finally access the support, there's other expectations on figuring out how to keep it in place even after you get it. So There's many, many layers to this.
Complicated systems to navigate. You also have to learn how to advocate for yourself. I imagine for children with autism, as a parent, you're trying to help them maybe take some of this on themselves, but you're also very much involved, and I imagine that depends on the severity of the child's autism, would you say?
Definitely. So for youth that have more challenges, that are more impacted by their autism, parents might be seeking guardianship or powers of attorney so that they have authority to speak for their youth.
Okay.
So that they're maybe navigating those systems for them or maybe in tandem, but really being the primary driver in accessing those supports. If the youth has enough cognitive ability that they're their own guardian, that they maybe aren't going to sign over powers of attorney to their parents, that becomes really difficult because the parents don't have the authority to speak for them anymore.
Once they're 18.
Once they're 18.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it's really up to the child, the adult child now to determine if they want their parents involved even.
Absolutely.
So that can be a conversation to have to navigate as well, it sounds like.
And it's a tricky age at best.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, this age can be a huge transition for any family. And Linda, you have personal experience with this, right? How old is your son?
My son is now 30.
So okay. So what was this like for you?
We started, by the time he was about 15, starting to look ahead and say, you know, I really figured out how to navigate and advocate through the school system. And I turned my attention to the adult system, which is entirely different, at about age 15, and said, I really have to start to figure out this other system. And so really turning to other parents, a little bit to the school district and to the internet, trying to figure out how to put all the parts and pieces. And my son has more needs, support needs. And so looking at things like Social Security and guardianship and future planning for estate planning and all those kind of more complex things are things that I had to investigate and navigate and figure out ways to educate, mostly myself, on how to get through those things.
I'm speaking with Linda Tortorelli. She's the Autism Program Coordinator at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm also joined by Megan Burke, Professor of Special Education at the U of I. Megan, I understand you also have some personal experience with this. Do you have a brother with autism as well?
I have a brother with Down syndrome.
Down syndrome.
So he's 26, and so I've helped my parents navigate adult services for him. And then I have a five-year-old with autism.
I see. What was it like for your brother, if you're able to talk about that, and your parents navigating this? Was it similar to what Linda just described?
Yeah, I would say it's difficult. It's definitely difficult to learn. I think it's almost misleading to call it the adult service delivery system because it's actually multiple systems and they usually don't speak to one another and they have different bureaucracies, different eligibility schemes, different services and supports they offer, and different ways to kind of maintain your eligibility. So it's hard as you leave school services where, you know, it's one school system that you're learning to navigate and advocate for services, to then switch gears and learn about multiple service delivery systems.
And you've both hinted at this. You mentioned that prior to age 18, when they're in the school system, it's all in one place because you're working through special education, mm-hmm. and that's kind of coordinating both the education and the other services that the child needs. So is that what it means when I understand that adult services are described as eligibility-driven, not entitlement-driven? Can you explain that distinction?
Sure. Okay. Education is a right that all children in the United States have. So you're eligible by being a child in the United States. So that's what the law entitles all children to. When it comes to adult services in Illinois, they are mostly based on you have to be eligible based on your disability, and then they have to be available. They have to be funded. So you might be eligible, but they might not be available. There is some level of entitlement, and there are states that have more entitlement than Illinois has, but our entitlement is very narrow, and the majority of our services are not entitlements in the adult service system.
That's interesting that you make the distinction between being eligible and actually being able to access the services. The services have to exist. Is the state not required to provide services to adults with disabilities who need it? Maybe that's a complex question.
It is a complex question. Yeah. It depends on which service you're talking about. There are multiple services. I think one that we think of most frequently is the Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services waiver. And so that's something that you can prove that you're eligible for and prove that you're eligible for supports in the home, so home-based supports, or community-based supports, so living in a group home or living in the community with supports. Some states have no waiting lists for those types of services. Illinois has a lengthy waiting list of about 20,000 people.
And I understand there are lawsuits associated with this particular aspect of it, right?
Yes.
Illinois is still heavily dependent on more institutional-type care. We still have 7 state-operated developmental centers. And we have many what are called intermediate care facilities. And those are part of our old entitlement system. But families and individuals today aren't looking for segregated living arrangements. They really want to be integrated in their communities and employment and social activities and living amongst, you know, neighbors. And we're very much an outlier in how we are funding our adult system. We're very heavily funding still these very segregated living that is not desirable.
Yeah. But you are both working within this space to try to make this easier to navigate within the current system we have, for better or worse. And so you recently received a grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to study a particular program known as ASSIST, and what difference that can make for families. Let's talk about the ASSIST program. What is it?
So the ASSIST program is a 12-week advocacy training program for parents of young adults with autism aged 16 to 26. The training program goes over how to advocate for adult services and then kind of different adult services that your youth may be eligible for. So those services vary, but they include vocational rehab services, so services to help you with employment, the Medicaid waiver that we already mentioned, supplemental security insurance, social security disability insurance, guardianship that Linda already mentioned, person-centered planning, Section 8 housing. The list goes on and on. 12 sessions and 2 hours for each session, so it's roughly 24 hours with some readings and a letter of intent that goes along with it. So it's a pretty intense training program to help parents learn what services are available, what may be appropriate for their youth, and then how to advocate for those services.
Okay. And so this program had already been implemented in Tennessee, right? And now it's here in Illinois in Naperville. Is that right?
Right. So we had Julie Lowndes Taylor, who's a professor at Vanderbilt, had received the initial grant, which was a pilot grant to develop and test ASSIST in Tennessee. So we tested it with 40 families, and that showed that when families went through the ASSIST program, they demonstrated significantly improved knowledge about adult services, advocacy skills, and empowerment. Mm. And then we measured them again about 6 months later, and their youth with autism had significantly decreased unmet service needs. So they were able to access more services, and they were more likely to be in post-secondary education settings or in employment. So we made an argument to scale it up to say, let's see if this works beyond Tennessee. Let's look at it and see if it works across 3 different states, 3 states that are very different from one another in terms of adult services, and see if it's something that we can kind of scale up nationally to help families. Because the issues we've mentioned, although Illinois has its problems, lots of families in lots of different states really struggle to access services.
And so in Illinois, you're scaling it up. So can families still sign up, or has it already been determined and now you're kind of studying to see how it affects the families that are enrolled?
So that's a good question. We've had we're still potentially looking for people. We're running it starting next week, and then we're going to offer another training in the fall. So people could contact us if they're interested. We've received a lot of feedback and a lot of interest, so we will definitely exceed the number of participants that we need for the actual study. But we're keeping track of people who are interested so that we're able to make sure that the materials and the curriculum, if it's effective, we can share with them after the study ends.
Hmm. Is there anything you would add to that, Linda?
Just to the point about making it scalable, we are looking at the autism program, which we call TAP, statewide, being able to be a home for this curriculum going forward, because part of the research was where could this be housed so that it just isn't sort of over when the research ends. So I'm going to be a trainer for these sessions, and we're the administration of TAP is very interested and committed to having this perhaps be the home for it going on into the future.
Because, I mean, are there other programs like this elsewhere that help specifically at this stage of life and with this transition, to your knowledge?
there isn't any programs to our knowledge that are this structured and organized. There's online information that parents can access quite a few different ways if they wanted to do some online learning. And this is part of the research, is there's a control group that's mm-hmm. going to have access to the materials just in a binder. And the participants are going to be followed for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be looking at, you know, what are the outcomes for the participants that actually took the live training, and what's the outcomes for the participants that just had the binder. Mm-hmm. Because it's not been studied. The outcomes have not been studied. Mm-hmm. Information has been made available in online format or paper format. But generally, any live programmings have been, like, come in here, a one-hour overview, or come to two sessions, and or parents can find a topic, somebody speaking about Social Security, and they just have to go decide that they want to listen to that topic. To my knowledge, there hasn't been anything that's been this structured to cover all the topics.
I also imagine it's just could be nice to have that kind of support from people who understand and can empathize with what you're going through. Do you think that that could play a role in this as well?
Yeah, in our pilot, when we ran it, the families really enjoyed meeting other parents of young adults with autism. I think they mentioned, you know, sometimes they feel disconnected, especially because the age of their youth, that they're not in school anymore, they're not meeting other parents. So they really enjoyed that social aspect of meeting other families who are having the same experiences. They can learn from one another and kind of gain some of that peer support. And I think part of our hypothesis is that the live training will be more effective than the materials because they'll have access to that peer support. But it is important to test because we're also looking at parents of young adults with autism who tend to be much more stressed than the rest of the population, who have a lot of things going on. We don't want to offer them a 24-hour training if they could yield the same benefit by just reading the materials.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit big picture just for the last minute here. You mentioned that Illinois is one of the worst states. Are there other states that are doing this better when it comes to support for adults with disabilities, whether it's autism or something else? Are there lessons that Illinois can learn from other states? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much all of them.
We are pretty much almost at the bottom of the barrel of all the states on how we provide community-based supports for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. There's only maybe about two or three states that do it worse than Illinois.
Mm-hmm. So, is it a matter of funding, or is it the way the system is designed?
I think it's a matter of philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly because we fund at a much higher rate our segregated services, you know, in institutions and in the ICF, these larger congregate living, and we don't fund community-based services at the same rates that we fund those segregated living. So while more dollars are needed for community-based, what really needs to happen is that these other systems that we're funding need to really come to an end. I think the majority of the states have zero or only one state-operated institution, while Illinois, the only state that has more institutions, is Texas than Illinois.
Because it's a whole idea of when you institutionalize a person, I mean, it's sort of like it can be viewed as warehousing. Or this was a shift that happened with mental health when institutions closed down. I mean, unfortunately, I've learned that there's been largely a failure to reinvest those dollars into the community-based care that you mentioned. But that is the idea of that's what it would take to actually really help families that are dealing
with this.
That's
exactly what it's going to take.
For you, Linda, I'm curious to hear, like, what difference would this kind of program have made when you were going through this transition over a decade ago?
It would have saved me probably 3 years worth of work that I did on my own, going to workshops and internet. And those things are wonderful and can supplement. But to really have in one place, like, okay, these are the components that I need to have an understanding about and customize it to where my son is or was would have been tremendously helpful. And I think the component of being with other parents on the journey, I was really doing this in isolation all the time. It really is helpful to hear other people's stories that might just be a step ahead of you. And I always really feel like paying it forward as well for the parents that are just kind of right behind me to say, here's what I found out, and offering those tips and tricks that I've learned along the way.
That was WILL and Side Effects Health reporter Christine Herman speaking with Linda Tortorelli, the autism program coordinator at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, who designed the ASSIST curriculum, and Megan Burke, also a professor at the U of I in special education and principal investigator of the ASSIST program. I'm Julian Haida. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida. When you think of crustaceans, what comes to mind? We humans know them mostly by the role they play in our meal times, like lobsters, crabs, and shrimp. But did you know that these are arthropods that are close relatives of insects? For 37 years, the Insect Fear Film Festival in Urbana has featured different kinds of insects and related critters, and crustaceans will be front and center at this year's event. WILL reporter Christine Herman spoke with the film festival's founder, University of Illinois entomologist May Barenbaum, about this year's theme.
For a long time, zoologists, including entomologists, assumed that the closest allies to insects were the arachnids, the spiders and mites and ticks and scorpions and their relatives. But it turns out, starting about 15 years ago, people began using molecular data, particularly genomic data, to look at the various groups of arthropods and came to the unmistakable realization that, in fact, the main reason that insects and arachnids look like they're closely related is that they're terrestrial. And in reality, if you look down at the gene level, insects are basically just terrestrial crustaceans.
Interesting.
They diversified wildly once they got onto land. Just to illustrate how successful the insect plan is for life on terrestrial Earth, there are about 1 million species of described insects, and the estimate of how many are yet to be described as upwards of 4-5 million. So maybe as many as 5.5 million or more. Some estimate as many as 30 million. By contrast, the number of known crustaceans is like 70,000. And there are a couple of families of insects that are bigger than that. There's longhorn beetles. There's like 30,000 species of longhorn beetles.
Wow.
But the crustaceans have really diversified within an aquatic context. The one place on the planet that you won't find in many insects at all is the deep ocean. Marine insects are pretty much limited to living on the top of the water, like ocean striders or, you know, like water striders, but in the ocean, or along the coastal areas. And it's thought that crustaceans are far older, according to the fossil record, than insects are. And maybe one reason insects are not well represented in marine environments is that crustaceans got there first. And they've done very well there. And, of course, they've also, there are crustaceans in terrestrial habitats, but they really have been successful in the marine environment.
Well, this is all really fascinating because I think for most people, when they think of crustacean or crabs, lobster, shrimp, crayfish, they don't necessarily realize that they're this closely related to insects. So that's fascinating. Why are crustaceans important? Or can you talk a little bit about the role they play within the ecosystems in which they live? And I understand this is outside of your expertise as an entomologist.
Oh, but well, in fact, one reason we find a theme for the festival every year is sort of focus a message and have not repeat the same. I think at this point, probably everyone who's been living in Champaign-Urbana for any length of time can explain to you why insects cannot be the size of mobile homes. So we've done that. We explain, you know, what are the constraints on insects in general in terms of growing big. But focusing on a particular aspect of arthropod life helps people learn new things. And this year, it's helping entomologists learn new things.
Sure.
I have to confess, I'm pretty ignorant about crustaceans. I have been, like, cramming to master enough so I sound at least a little bit credible. In fact, as you know, when I came into the studio, I was just double-checking to make sure that, in fact, a scientist who specializes on crustaceans is called a carcinologist, and I wanted to make sure that wasn't just an individual who studies crabs, because Carcinus is a genus of crabs. It is. But don't ask Siri, because then she will tell you the name of allergists in Carson City, Nevada. So we're learning along with the general public. In terms of their importance to humans, well, what most people immediately think of when you say crustacean is they're delicious. And in fact, we eat about 8 million tons of crustaceans every year. And, you know, mostly shrimp, lobsters, crabs, their relatives. But in terms of their role in ecosystems, probably most marine food webs are based on crustaceans in the form of krill. And krill constitute a group of crustaceans, very small, that are staples for so many marine organisms. Hmm. So just like in terrestrial food webs, insects are kind of near the bottom. Same thing in marine ecosystems, although there are very large crustaceans that are at tops of food webs. In fact, it's astonishing how large the largest crustaceans are.
How large are they?
Okay. So glad you asked that question. You know, entomologists have a range of orders of magnitude they're used to dealing with, but the span is probably definitely greater for crustaceans. The very smallest crustacean is less than a tenth of a millimeter, which is 4/1,000th of an inch. And this is a tiny little parasitic crustacean that is a parasite on a tiny little aquatic crustacean called a copepod. The very largest is the Japanese spider crab, which is a marine crab from Japan, and its leg span is about 12 and a half feet. It weighs over 40 pounds.
Wow.
A lot of crab legs. It's like a buffet all by itself.
That's amazing.
So that's when people think of crustaceans, they think of dinner, not so much insects.
at least not in the U.S.
Right, at least definitely not in the U.S. And I think humans have arguably longer history eating insects, but there are ancient records of crustacean meals that go back to 164,000 years ago.
Wow.
So we've not only do we eat a lot of them, we've been doing it for a very long time.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the films that you've got lined up. So the first, it's a kid-friendly anthology of crustaceans in TV and film. So that's like to start off the festival. It's like kid-friendly.
Yeah, very kid-friendly.
Yeah.
And frankly, our first feature, which is from the 50s, 1957, very unlikely to scare anybody.
Okay. Actually, I wanted to play a little clip from the trailer for The Attack of the Crab Monsters. It's a feature-length film from 1957. Let's take a listen.
On an isolated Pacific island, the Navy lands a party of daring scientists to solve the mysterious disappearance of an entire atomic research team. Strange horror strikes first at the plane that brought them. And then, earth-shattering tremors begin tearing the island to shreds.
Okay, Professor, how are the crabs blowing up the island?
I am not sure, but imagine they are able to send out arcs of heat. They are pecked with it.
I'm speaking with May Barenbaum, U of I entomologist and one of the lead organizers of this event. May, can you talk a little bit about why you chose this particular film?
Attack of the Crab Monsters was an easy choice. Usually we like our first feature to be at least family-friendly, and the movies from the 50s are before, I guess, gore was featured and plot lines made a difference. This is kind of very derivative in that this was the era of the, you know, atomic radiation-induced giant creatures. So there's atomic testing in the Pacific, and a consequence is that there are now giant crabs, although just a couple of them, but they seem to have loose electrons. Bullets pass through them, so it's hard to take a sample. And they are able to absorb the electron energy of other creatures, including humans, and somehow that confers upon them the ability to speak in the voices of these other humans. They need to get off the island before the crabs outwit them. The problem with making crabs the bad guys is that they're sort of endearing. That walking sideways thing is really cute.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many cartoons about crabs. These are not sort of designed to be cute. And in fact, in reality, there are many invasive species of crabs that do massive damage to coastal ecosystems. Hmm. But in general, people feel favorably disposed toward them. So this is an unusual role for setting up a conflict between humans and the crustacean world.
And then what about the second film? It's called The Bay, and I understand it's based in a small Maryland town. Chaos breaks out after an ecological disaster. What is this one all about?
So this is actually a much higher quality movie than we're accustomed to showing, but I thought it would be a great choice because it is one of the more obscure groups of of crustaceans. This features an isopod. Most familiar isopods to people are pill bugs or sow bugs, roly-polies. This is not a roly-poly here. This is a marine isopod, the biology of which is based on an actual crustacean, Cymathoa exigua. This is called the tongue-eating louse, is its common name. And this is a species that is a parasite of red snapper fish. And what it does is basically enters the fish's mouth, consumes the fish's tongue, latches onto the stump of the tongue, and then becomes the fish's tongue for the rest of that fish's life. This is real.
Wow. Definitely sounds more like a something out of sci-fi, but that's
it, well, it
happens.
Worked its way into sci-fi.
Yeah.
Barry Levinson, the director, who has a lot of legitimate credits to his name, Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, I mean, he's the legitimate Hollywood director, was asked about whether he'd be interested in making a documentary about pollution in Chesapeake Bay. There are a lot of chicken farms, chicken excrement gets in, human waste, and it has created sort of a biological desert. 40% of the estuary is dead. And he knew that there was already a Frontline documentary about the state of the Chesapeake Bay, and no one really cared. And he thought maybe people would care more if we did some more creative storytelling. So he took the concept of the documentary, is that the water is very polluted. There's many chemicals. It's inimical to normal life. And then sort of put a twist on it where these isopods move away from their red snapper hosts. That's not part of the film, but they start on a 4th of July festival, which features, by the way, a Miss Crustacean contest and a crab-eating competition. The isopods start eating humans, particularly ripping out their tongues, and it's very gory. And
it's rated R, yeah.
It's rated R, yes. Don't bring your kids. It's sort of a found footage approach where, in reality, a lot of it was improvised, and some of it was shot on cell phones, just like you might, you know, that's the sort of footage you would cobble together to do a found footage documentary. It was just so apt, you know. That film alone, a chance to show this film and talk about this very strange crustacean, pretty much justifies a crustacean fear film festival.
So there's also a live insect crustacean petting zoo. What kinds of creatures can people expect to meet there?
Well, that's one of the really distinctive features of this year's festival. We have, in addition to our usual menagerie of six-legged creatures, we have creatures with many more legs. In fact, a crab, lobster, they're in a group called the decapods, which means 10 legs. And there are crustaceans with even more. We have, among the decapods, we will have vampire crabs. We're going to have blue crabs and spider crabs. We have cherry shrimp, clam shrimp, fairy shrimp. We'll have live crayfish, a whole diversity of isopods in honor of the stars of our second feature, including one species that's tangerine orange. And we have triops, which are small crustaceans that are pretty similar to what was around about 400 million years ago, a really ancient life form.
Yeah.
They're called triops because they have three eyes. There are so many strange things about
crustaceans. And this is a petting zoo, so at least some of these are safe to touch?
Yes, and be prepared to get your hands wet, right?
Yeah.
Because they're aquatic, so.
Can we talk a little bit about, I mean, you've been doing this for 37 years. What is your big goal for doing this event all these years?
I guess the main goal of the festival is to help people understand the value and the fascination of biodiversity. And if any phylum sort of embodies biodiversity, it's the arthropods. When you say insect, to most people, they think of pests like mosquitoes. Sometimes they think of ticks, which is not an insect. You know, ticks are not an insect, or spiders, which are not insects. So it's just to share with the public our fascination for the astonishingly diverse variety of ways they've found to make a living on this planet. The best thing I've always thought about being an entomologist is that there's free entertainment almost year-round. I mean, things are slow right now, but You know, you can go in your backyard. You don't have to go to, you know, a rainforest. You don't have to climb to the, you know, the peaks of the highest mountains. They're everywhere. And our lives intersect with them, whether you like it or not.
Hmm. Well, it's always fun to talk with you, May. May Barenbaum is professor and head of the entomology department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's also been leading a big team of people in putting on the Insect Fear Film Festival every year for 37 years now. Thanks for being here, May.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
For those of you listening from East Central Illinois, the 37th annual Insect Fear Film Festival kicks off this Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Follinger Auditorium. We'll tweet out more information if you follow us at 21STShow. That's all the time we have for the show today. I'm Julian Haida. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you so much for listening.